In the interim, but I want to welcome everyone here, and there are a number of things that we'd like to cover, and we've kind of combined a number of different issues on to cover today. And I want to welcome Senator Clark. I believe you're on the phone.
I am. Thank you for doing this, Mike.
Great. Hope your summer hasn't been too overly busy. And we also have a number of House members. I know Representative Greiling was here. Welcome, and appreciate the opportunity. Someone said, is this the conference committee? And I said, no, we're just trying to work together and get some information so that we can come into the session a little more prepared and deal with the issues at hand. The things that I would like to touch on, there are a number of issues. Certainly, we're going to start out with charter schools. And what I'd like to do is to have, I believe, Commissioner Segrin, welcome. We'll bring us up to date a little bit on the laws or the legislation that we passed last year. Give us an update, and then we would like to spend some time on the a very important issue, and one I think all of us probably can bring some consensus to, and that is the legislation, the federal legislation that the new administration has, which is called Race to the Top. And as you know, the state's budget is not in a robust shape. But this gives us some opportunity, I think, for education, public education in the state of Minnesota to access some additional dollars with the caveat there are some strings attached, and we want to find out exactly what those requirements might be, how we might participate in that, and be sure that we can bring as many people and many institutions together, working hopefully toward a common goal there in that arena. And then a little bit later, we'll have some discussion about the integration aid issue and what is happening there. And I believe that subcommittee will meet after we're done as a full committee. And I don't know if you have an exact time, but I think it's after after we're done here. So would like to begin, but before I do, I have one announcement, and I just want to take this opportunity, lest I forget or don't mention it later on, that we are going to be losing our committee administrator, Kevin McHenry. And Kevin has worked very well with, I think, all of the committee members in the whole Senate and other staff, and we certainly appreciate all that he's done, keeping me out of trouble and helping everyone along the way. So we want to extend our appreciation, certainly as chair and I think as the other committee members too. So that's going to be a loss for our committee, but we hope wish him well in his new endeavor. And
you're going to tell us what it is?
I think yes, Kevin, you want to mention where you're going and
see if we approve or not?
Mr. Chair, members, I did accept a position at the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, so I will be still around the Capitol, but maybe covering other areas other than education. So
I'll be after you.
Good. You may see me on the benches out there.
So with that, welcome, Commissioner. And we heard that you had a very busy, busy summer, and that you described the perfect storm, so to speak. I know the department and all of the districts across the state are worried and concerned about the H1N1 flu. And I hope that we do whatever is possible to kind of minimize the impact of that. But I know a lot of districts are being affected, and I believe you mentioned earlier that your own department has had some hits in that area. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Stumpf and members. It's wonderful to be back with you again. I hope you all had a good summer. And Kevin, congratulations on your new move. And I also, too, our staff has appreciated Kevin's relationship and helpfulness, too. So you're going to be missed, but wish you well in your new position. We'll get right into the charter school overview, and I do want to apologize. Generally, the folks that work really in depth with charter schools would be here, but as the senator said, we're dealing with quite a bit of sickness in our agency. So while I worked a lot on charter schools when I was in the legislature, other people have kind of taken over a lot of that responsibility. So I hope I can answer your questions to the best of my ability. But if there are things that I don't know, we will absolutely get those questions answered for you. So first of all, we want to go over the new authorizer eligibility requirements and standards. And we are going to be, this will be just pretty much basically coming out of the legislation that passed, but it will be a review for all of you to look at it. We rename the sponsor to now call sponsors authorizers. We've established a new approval process for authorizers, and we define categories of standards for the authorizer approval process. We are establishing a 5-year review cycle for authorizers. Also, we create new eligibility requirements for authorizers, and we allow additional authorizer fees for new oversight responsibilities. So once you become an authorizer, you can actually charge a larger fee for the oversight of the charter school that you're responsible for. We have changes in the term length of a contract with a charter school, and components of the contract between a charter school and authorizer have also been enhanced. Now, the new authorizer eligibility requirements, before an authorizer that has chartered a school before August 1st, 2009, must apply to the commissioner by June 30th, 2011 to be reauthorized or to continue as an authorizer. If you fail to do that, then you will not be an authorizer after June 30th, 2011. The existing authorizers cannot authorize new charter schools until they meet the eligibility requirements and categories of standards for authorization under the new provisions. So even if you are asked to charter a new one and you're an old authorizer, you still have to go through that authorization process. Now, new authorizers may apply to the commissioner to authorize a charter school prior to June 30th, 2011, and must immediately meet the new authorizer requirements and standards. And then this past legislative session, we also authorized what we call single-purpose authorizers. Those are entities that their sole purpose is to sponsor charter schools, and they will have to meet the same criteria. The eligible sponsors, just to go over that with you, to remind you who can sponsor a charter school, is a school board, an intermediate school district, an education district organized under state statute, higher ed institutions that grant 2 or 4-year degrees, a charitable organization, and there is some new language here, excluding a non-public sectarian or religious institution, any person other than a natural person that directly or indirectly through one or more intermediaries controls or is controlled by or under common control with the non-public sectarian or religious institution, and any other charitable organization under this clause that would indicate that they are organized for a religious purpose. In addition to that, that this is old requirements. You must be a member of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits or the Minnesota Council on Foundations. You must be registered with the Office of the Attorney General. You must have at least a $2 million fund balance in your nonprofit, and you must be incorporated in the state of Minnesota. Now, the new authorizer categories are standards. These are just kind of the broad categories. We will be looking at the capacity to sponsor and the infrastructure of that authorizer. There will be an application criteria and process established. There will be a contracting process that we will be expecting all authorizers to demonstrate. They will have to demonstrate that they are willing to have ongoing oversight and an evaluation process for their charter schools. And there will be renewal criteria and processes for authorizers when we do renew them every 5 years. The new authorizer categories of standards. In addition to the new authorizer standards, an authorizer must, at a minimum, provide evidence that it has met the following standards. How chartering schools is a way for the organization to carry out its mission. So even if your primary mission is not charter schools, you must demonstrate how it is part of your mission. A description of the capacity of the organization to serve as an authorizer, including personnel information and financial resources. A description of the type of contract it will arrange with the schools it charters that meets the obligations that are set forth in the statute. A description of the application and review process the authorizer will use to make decisions regarding the granting of charters. So we want to assure that this isn't just somebody comes to an authorizer and says, I want to start a charter school, and they say, oh, yeah, we'll do that. Even if they've got the financial resources and the capacity, we want to know that they are also very thoughtful about the contract that is being set up with that new charter. The process also to be used for providing ongoing oversight of the school, the process for making decisions regarding the renewal or termination of a school's contract, and assurance that the organization will serve as the authorizer for at least 5 years. So we want to see that commitment demonstrated. The application for existing and new authorizers will be made available in January of 2010. And prospective authorizers may apply to the commissioner on a rolling basis throughout the year. So we're not going to have just certain times. We will have that process going forth all year long. The next part is talking about the new approval, oversight, and renewal process for authorizers. An authorizer must submit an affidavit to the commissioner for approval for every school it intends to charter. The affidavit must demonstrate eligibility and standards to authorize and provide information to the commissioner about the proposed charter school's finances, operations, governance, among other requirements. So we also want the assurance that this charter school is going to have a strong foundation as they go forward. And then I must approve or disapprove this affidavit within 60 business days of receipt of the affidavit. We will be reviewing authorizers at least once every 5 years, and the findings must be reported to the authorizer and are subject to corrective action if we do find that there are things that are not being followed. Authorizers must attend department-approved training, and the next training for authorizers will take place in October this month, 2009. Then I can move to terminate a contract between an authorizer and a charter school for failing to demonstrate the criteria that we've just talked about, violating a term of the chartering contract between the authorizer and a charter school board, or unsatisfactory performance as an approved authorizer. Next, we want to look at the governance of charter schools. New charter schools have to have certain things met. The board of directors must be composed of at least 5 non-related members and must include at least 1 licensed teacher that's employed at the school or a licensed teacher that's providing instruction under a contract between the charter school and a cooperative, because we do have a couple of charter organizations like that. A parent or a legal guardian of a student that's enrolled in the charter must be on the board. An interested community member who is not employed by the charter school and does not have a child enrolled. And then the chief financial officer and the chief administrator are ex officio non-voting members of the board. The new board governance requirements, board bylaws shall outline the process and procedures for changing the board's governance model consistent with Chapter 317A. And a board may change its governance model only by a majority vote of the board and the licensed teachers employed by the school board and with the authorizer's approval. So now you have a very strong and transparent system of making sure that your bylaws are discussed with all of the people that are engaged with the charter school. We have charter school board training requirements. Every charter school board member must receive department-approved training on board governance, the board's roles and responsibilities, the employment policies and practices, and financial management. Just like our Minnesota School Boards Association works with our public school board members, when I was a board member, I went through the school board training. It's very, very important for board members to understand their responsibilities as due to the, you know, just to the public financial obligations and the educational obligations that they are overseeing for the children that are in their schools. Board members must begin training within 6 months of being elected to the board and complete training within 12 months of being seated on the board, or they will be ineligible to continue serving as a board member. The department will hold 12 board training sessions in November and December of 2009 and in January and February of 2010, focused on financial management and employment law. And then the department is also going to issue an RFP in December of this year, requesting proposals from prospective providers of training. So we are also interested very much in people that would like to take this training on. Frankly, we just don't have enough people to do all of this training, and we think that there are some really good professional folks out there that could take this duty on. The approved list of department providers will be established in February of 2010, and then the training will be ongoing throughout the year. Next, we're going to review the rules, the new rules of conflicts of interest. This includes owners, employees, or agents of a contractor of both nonprofit and for-profit entities. Nonprofit were added to the law in 2009. So there are conflict of interest provisions. No member of the board of directors, an employee, an officer, or an agent of a charter school shall participate in selecting, awarding, or administering a contract if there is a conflict of interest existing. Board members, then this is where the conflict is established and exists. When it involves the board member, employee, officer, or agent, the immediate family member of a board member, employee, officer, or agent, the partner of a board member, employee, officer, or agent, or an organization that employs or is about to employ an individual in the clauses above, or has a financial or other interest in the entity with which the charter school is contracting. A violation of the conflict of interest subdivision renders the contract void. Any employee, agent, or board member of the authorizer who participates in the initial review, approval, ongoing oversight, evaluation, or the charter renewal or non-renewal process or decision is ineligible to serve on the board of directors of a school chartered by that authorizer. Next, we have some new provisions on affiliated building corporations. An affiliated building corporation for the purposes of the charter school must be incorporated under Sections 317A and comply with applicable IRS regulations, submit to the commissioner each fiscal year a list of current board members and a copy of its annual audit report, comply with Chapter 13, that's the Government Data Practices Law, must not serve as the leasing agent for property or facilities it does not own. And then in the future, a charter school may form an affiliated building corporation for the purposes of remodeling or purchasing an existing site under the following conditions. The charter school has to have been in operation at least 5 years, and the school's charter has been renewed for 5 years. The charter has a net positive unreserved fund balance as of June 30th in the preceding 5 fiscal years. The charter has a long-range strategic plan and financial plan The charter school has to complete a feasibility study of available buildings. So in other words, if they want to remodel or buy an existing, they have to also, establish that there is a need to do so, or that there is no other solution for them. The charter school documents sustainable enrollment projections. That's very important if you're going to expand or even remodel. We want to make sure that there is sustainability in enrollment. Now, if you want to create a building corporation for the purposes of constructing new, you have to demonstrate that there's a lack of facility available before you start to think about building new. You have to be, as a charter, in operation at least 8 years. You also have to have demonstrated a positive net unreserved general fund balance for 8 years as of the June 30th deadline. Complete a feasibility study, as in the previous slide. Have a long-range strategic and financial plan that includes the sustainability of enrollment projections and demonstrates the need for the new facility. And you must have a positive review and comment, just like our school districts have to have a positive review and comment when they are building new or remodeling. This would be subject to the same requirements. There is a new implementation update. The department requested in July of 2009 the following information from charter schools and their affiliated building corporations pursuant to the new charter school provision that's now in law. Proof of incorporation under Section 317A, copies of their IRS forms 990 and 1023, the list of the building corporation board members and certification that no conflict exists, proof of building ownership, and a copy of the building corporation's annual audit. To date, 5 of 28 of our known affiliated building corporations have responded to the department's request. The remainder of the charter schools did not respond to the department's request as of October 8, 2009. The application process for new affiliated building corporations will be available in February of 2010. And then finally, just to give an overview of some of the new provisions, a charter school must comply with all applicable federal, state, and local health and safety requirements. The charter must comply with the statewide accountability requirements, must be subject to the state online learning provisions, because we do have a lot of charters that are online providers. A charter school must provide release time for students for religious instruction. That's been a clarification of some situations that we wanted to make sure people understood. A charter school board is subject to state employment law under Chapter 181, and a charter school is subject to the Data Practices Act and open meeting laws under Chapter 13 and 13D. So that concludes my overview of all of our new charter school revisions for this year.
Just a couple questions, and then there's some of the committee members have some questions. Can you go back to why only 5 out of the 28 responded to the department's request for information?
Senator Stumpf, we do not know why. We have contacted them, asked for the information, and there has been no response from those.
Was the request, Commissioner, was the request fairly clear in what the department was requesting?
Yes.
The only other question I have is under Chapter 181, what actually, I should know, but what actually is the Chapter 181 requirements?
That's the general employment law. So that protects employees, when they're, there's certain regulations when people are laid off, when they're, fired. It's, eligibility for, probably workers' compensation and kind of the general employment law that governs contractual law, among individuals.
Okay. Senator Olson and then Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Stump's initial question, of only five responding. We do have, the purposes are in law, apply to current as well as future. But there, did we not have any requirement of current to supply the information? Or is there, if at some point they haven't, you do not have on record and know that they comply, do you have the right to say that they do, are not authorized to exist?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, at this point, the legislation instructed us to collect the information, as I understand it. Dr. Melcher is here. He's actually got a little bit more background information on the existing affiliated corporations, who they are, and he can. Did you, Dr. Melcher, did you have some information that you could share?
So, Mr. Chair,
well, it's, Senator Olson,
the Commissioner, it's one thing to tell you to do it, so then we slap your hands if you can't get it, and yet there's nothing. There is no accountability on the side of the one who's supposed to provide it. Is there? I mean, I'd like some clarity there, because that seems a little odd that they've not responded at all, telling you that they're preparing it or something to show that there is a good faith effort to comply.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I haven't been involved, engaged with the collection process. All I know is that we sent out very specific requests to ask for this information so that we could gather it, so we could have an understanding of what's going on with the affiliated corporations, and only five of the 28 responded. Now, I don't think anyone has slapped our hands or is intending to do that. You know, I think we're trying to work together with you to try to create a really transparent and strong process for allowing our charter schools to be able to do something like this. And we've kind of struggled for years of how to allow facilities to exist for charter schools. And, you know, this is certainly one way of doing it. And I hope that we can have a really good, strong process in place. But I also hope that we can work with those that are creating these affiliated building corporations so that we know the status of what's going on and that things are being clearly done that meet the requirements of the law. Dr. Melcher, I don't know if you have some additional.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I do have materials, if you're interested in them, that you know, list the 28 schools and which ones have provided us the data and which ones haven't. We do have one staff person in my division that works on the charter school building lease aid applications as well as collecting some of this data. And the primary focus that we've had up to this point in time is getting the lease aid applications in and approved. We still have some charter schools that have not submitted the data or that they've submitted the data late, and we're still working to process those. And given some of the cash flow issues that are out there for charter schools, our priority has been to try to get the lease aid applications taken care of so that the dollars can be flowing out. So we haven't done a lot in terms of follow-up on the original request at this point in time, just because of the staffing kind of situation that we're in there.
So,
Senator Olson.
So Mr. Chair and Dr. Melcher, do you have any authority to not act on the lease aid application without the information as to whether the building corporation has met the criteria by supplying the information?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, we believe that because of the August 1st effective date for that particular section of the law, that we don't have the authority to withhold lease aid based on that data. That is information that the schools are required to provide, but that it's not a condition of receiving the lease aid for the current school year, and therefore we have approved a number of schools that have given us all of the other data that we needed to determine their lease aid, but not that particular piece of the data.
Senator Saltzman.
I imagine It's very hard to know where to begin, Mr. Chair, because we made a really good faith effort this last session to work with our legislative auditor's report from 2003, which addressed the affiliated building corporations and the fact that there was a suggestion that perhaps some had created a loophole. And I think you yourself have read statute where, you know, charter schools may not use lease aid to build buildings and so or else to buy them. And we really tried to work on legislation that would acknowledge that these affiliated building corporations exist. And I felt that we did a really good job of starting that process to begin to at least have a way of collecting information. And this just feels like our efforts to really work with our charter schools, and it's not all charter schools, but the ones that are not complying with this, is very, very troubling at a time when there have been a number of stories out there in the press that people are asking questions, that this should be a way for charter schools to protect themselves. That was a lot of legislation that I carried this past year and that I worked with many different people on, was to say this is to protect schools that are doing everything right. And this is, and these are public dollars, and why would anyone not want to demonstrate they're using these dollars efficiently, effectively, and they're going to the correct use. So I am very concerned that, and it's one thing if some of these schools are just haven't gotten around to sending it. I would be extremely troubled if there is a response that we don't have to give you this, and that was not the intent of the legislation. So I would like to see the list at some point, Mr. Melcher, of who is not complying with the information. Maybe others at the table would too, because I think that we've made a really good request, and we did note that we need to do more work, but this seemed to be a good first step of at least being able to understand. And there's nothing in this list of information that anyone, I understand why there would be a resistance to providing this, because these are public dollars at a time when there are a lot of questions, and we should be assuring the public that these dollars are being spent correctly. So I don't know that if that's a question, but I guess, Commissioner, I would like to offer is that I do think that we want to work with the department to give you the tools, again, just for transparency. That's what this is all about, is that at this time with limited dollars, we should be able to answer the questions that the public is asking on this very important issue. And again, I just hope that I thought we had really tried to work with all the stakeholder groups on this particular issue.
Well, I think following up on that, I think the question to Dr. Melcher and Commissioner Segrin would be is, we created a lot of new legislation last year, and as you look over that information, is there anything that you think would be helpful from the legislative perspective that we could, I mean, do you have enough authority to pursue that that information, or do you need some changes to make things work out better in the implementation of what the intent of the laws were? I mean, those might be the questions that, if you don't have an answer right now, at least ponder and let us know so that we can help you or help the department carry out the implementation of what our intent was as we passed it last year.
Mr. Chair, we certainly are going to make some more attempt at contacting the people that did not respond, so we're going to give them another chance. Perhaps this hearing will spur some people on to understand the importance of complying. And then Dr. Melcher and I were just, you know, talking as you were speaking, too, about some things. We'd like to work with our staff to say, all right, in our process as we're reviewing things and putting whatever approval together, I think we'll go back to our staff and say, are there some key points, times during the process that this would be important? How would it fit in? So I think give us a little time to follow up with the people that didn't provide the information. We'll talk internally about some ideas of maybe where we could ask for your support, and then we'll get back to you and give you some response to maybe next steps of how to handle this. Okay. Be glad to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, the material that I just passed out, the first page is just a five-year history of the totals for USAID across the state. The next three pages is a listing of the lease aid for each of the individual charter schools for this last school year, which identifies cost of the number of students and the cost per square foot and so forth. Page six is the page where we're identifying the 28 schools with affiliated building corporations and where we're at and which five have submitted all of the data. And we have 17 that have had the rate approved but have not given us that particular data. We have three that haven't even submitted an application for lease aid yet, and three that we're in the process of reviewing the data that have been submitted. And the last page, page seven, is just the status of the lease aid applications for the current year for 2010. 75% of the schools have been approved. 12% are in the process of being approved, and 13% have not submitted their request for lease aid yet.
Mm-hmm. One potential issue might be, and I'll have our staff explain what might have caused some confusion, and I'm not sure. This is just a hunch, but maybe if you want to.
Mr. Chair and members and Commissioner, the subdivision that I'm looking at is Subdivision 17A. It's the Affiliated Nonprofit Building Corporation, and that subdivision says that upon organizing an affiliated nonprofit building corporation that certain documentation needs to be submitted to the commissioner, but there's nowhere in there that says that an affiliated nonprofit organization needs to submit the information to the commissioner. And is it possible that maybe the charter schools are that have already organized these affiliated nonprofits are seeing that this law doesn't apply to them?
Mr. Chair, that certainly could be one of the rationale. I don't know. I can't put you'd probably have to get them up here to ask that, but that could be a possibility that they're looking at the current law and interpreting it that way.
I think it was the intent of this committee and the conference committee that information would be supplied by all of the organizations, and maybe that's just the way it got drafted that might have created that. Senator Olson.
Mr. Quaid, where is the language that directs the department to collect that from all? If they're to collect that information, is that in statute too, or was that in session law?
Ms. McQuaid.
They're instructed to obtain that information. This, it was clear even in the notes that to become a new one, what you have to do. But see, we put the onus on the department to collect it from the others without any, real either requirement or consequence of not providing it.
Ms. McQuaid.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this is Subdivision 17 is only requiring the affiliated nonprofit building corporation upon organization, but I haven't found anywhere elsewhere in statute that actually directs the department to collect the information that they've listed in the slide.
So that's not in there either.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Dr. Melcher, we've got the 17A in front of us, too, and Dr. Melcher and I were kind of looking at it. And if you go down further into Subdivision B, there's also some instruction there. It just the that whole area section seems to have a little bit of a mixed message. I don't know. Dr. Melcher, you may want to comment on some of the other requirements.
Mr. Chairman, members, there are four paragraphs in that particular subdivision, and the first paragraph, paragraph A, is very clearly talking about what's required before a new corporation is organized. Paragraph B just says that an affiliated corporation must provide certain data. And then paragraph C, again, goes into organizational issues. I think part of the confusion surrounding this has to do with the effective date for the entire section, which puts on August 1. Let me see if I can find that. As this section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to all contracts and affidavits approved and contracts entered into or modified beginning August 1st, 2009. So it's kind of a gray area there when you say it's effective immediately or the day following final enactment, but then applying to contracts that are amended after August 1st. So there's some lack of clarity or something that could be cleaned up in legislation as far as whether clearly this applies only to if you're talking about the things that are related to organizing a new one, only to the ones that are organized after August 1st, but it's, I think, maybe a little unclear as to whether some of these data reporting requirements apply to all of the schools. We've requested the information from all of the schools. We think that was the intent. But that may be something that could be clarified in legislation, that's something that was needed for all of them.
Great. Thank you for the explanation. Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, do you know when the letter was sent out? How long ago was the letter sent to the charter schools asking for the information?
I believe it was in July.
We'll check. Dr. Melcher said thought in July.
And then follow up.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the slides on page 2 where it talks about the commissioner's ability to move to terminate a contract for various reasons, now, in retrospect and looking at that, do you feel as though that is strong enough the way it's worded, or do you think that there's anything that's missing in terms of, you know, the language appears to be permissive, but does it give the department the kind of strength in making those decisions that might be needed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, I think that this is kind of an overview of what authority I have to end a charter, and if you dig into it a little bit more, there's some pretty specific reasons why.
Okay.
I think I have some pretty good authority to close a charter.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Is there anyone that wants to testify on this?
Sure.
Come on. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Stump and Piccolo. Members. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Just to make two comments. One is we were very supportive of all these provisions that were put into law and worked very closely with Senator Saltzman and other members to enact these changes, and we believe they will do the job as time goes forward. In terms of these building companies, our belief was that this applies to providing information, applies to all building companies, and we'd be more than happy.
Do I push it?
This today was the first time I saw a list of that schools had not complied, and we will get after these schools to get this stuff in. And that's a commitment we'll make to you to work with the department to get this stuff in. But this is the first time I had seen that there was a list of schools that had not submitted stuff. So just wanted to say that.
Thank you very much. And we appreciate all the work last year as we were working our way through this, and I know Senator Saltzman and many of the committee members here, along with the House, you know, spent a lot of time and realizing that there were a lot of changes, and It's been a pleasure working with you, and look forward to moving all of this forward to make it a, you know, public education in the state of Minnesota a positive aspect. So, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got a couple questions about the board changes and the board governance changes, but the board training sessions. And there's a little bit of ambiguity here, too. The department, took a pretty strong hit in terms of cuts you had to make, and yet it does indicate that you are required to do the 12 board training sessions. And then your plan is to go with an RFP to get others to do that. Are you, do you have the capability of delivering on that? Because the statement ahead, and I don't know the exact wording in the board, in the slide ahead on page 3, board members must begin training within 6 months. Now, 6 months of what? Is this all new board members, or is it current board members have to go through this training as well? And then complete training within 12 months of being seated on the board, or they'll be ineligible. Is this training requirement only for new board members, or is this training requirement, again, applying to all existing ones as well?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it is a requirement for all board members to have the training. So if you're a seated board member or if you're going to be a new board member, you have to receive the training. In regard to your question about the capacity of the department, we will be doing the training, but what we are planning on doing, so we're going to try to get the training up and running with the capacity that we have. In December and January and February, but then what we would like to do is actually, have an RFP process, and if there are some organizations that could do this board training on an ongoing basis, we'd have a list of providers that could then do this, and we would certainly have a close working relationship with them, making sure that that they are doing the appropriate board training. But that is our plan, is to try to ask another organization that may have that training capability already and can do the job for us.
Senator Olson.
Then back to the, if all existing board members, it says board members must begin training within 6 months of what? Some of them have been on the board for a period of time and complete it within 12 months of being seated on the board. Does that apply only to the new in terms of the requirement, or how does that work with the existing board members?
Senator Saltzman, do you have on this?
Okay. Yes. On this issue, Mr. Chair, the point of this was that it was really targeted to new board members, that before that they had to complete to have the training. I believe it was a year, but the idea was that if you wait a full year before you even start it, we need to get, these board members trained. So that was where we inserted to begin within 6 months. Okay. And to complete it within a year.
That's only new.
That is, and it specifically said, to remain on the board. I believe that the language is to remain on the board. You needed to complete the training by the end of a year, and you needed to start it within 6 months so that you weren't doing all of it in the last, month or something like that. That was the intent, I believe, if I remember.
McCoy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, Senator Saltzman, the paragraph specifies that every board member shall attend department approved training, and then the clarification on that within 6 months is of being seated. So that
Mr. Chair, what if they were seated 2 years ago?
Ms. McCoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I would assume that then the next round of the language says that it's every board member, but if they've already been seated, I would assume that this doesn't apply to them.
Mr. Chair, what's the effective date of this provision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I believe this provision also is August 1st, 2009.
Mr. Piccolo.
Senators, our understanding was, as Senator Saltzman explained, that it went in effect with new board members elected after August 1st. Many of our boards have been receiving training. We provide training and have for the last 3 years. And so many of our boards that are seated currently have received training. Our expectation and what we have told the schools is, even if they have not been trained, they should comply with this law and get those people trained within, you know, their term on the board right now. So we are strongly encouraging people, even if they have not been trained and they were elected before August 1st, that they go to the trainings.
Senator Olson.
Do you mean even if they have been trained? Or did you mean what you said, that even if they've not been trained?
Well, both, existing. Because under the current law, there now needs to be a documentation that people have been trained. If people have not been trained, they should go. We're encouraging because, for example, the personnel training has never been something that's been offered before. This is to meet the compliance of 181, adherence to 181. So that'll be a new offering to charter school boards to understand personnel practices and policies and laws. So that all of them should take that, whether they've been on the board for the last 2 years or 4 years or 5 years.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
And Mr. Piccolo, are you also encouraging, you said even if they've not been trained, are you encouraging those that have been trained by your organization to also take this training?
If they have already taken the courses that, the training that applies to basic roles and responsibilities.
Then they wouldn't have to.
We would not, I mean, but we're encouraging that all board members get trained in all areas. Not only what the law says, but also other areas. Because there's a lot of other topics beyond those three topics in the law.
I think we will move on. This is a very important issue and one that I'm encouraging Senator Saltzman and subcommittee on, you know, to take a look at and maybe work with the commissioner on some of these things that are unclear. In particular, I think, related to the public facilities. And if you could probably have Senator Saltzman and maybe Commissioner have information kind of put together by February 1st, mm-hmm. that would be available then before session. Mm-hmm. And we could, maybe one of the first hearings we have, we could go back over it and hope that any clarifications can be made, any other suggestions can be entertained or discussed. So, all right, Commissioner, are you going to also do the second one on the race to top to the top?
Mr. Chair, you're stuck with me again.
All right.
What we're going to be looking at is some information that we received from the U.S. Department of Education, some of the Deputy Secretary presentations that I've attended, some of the presentations that I've attended with Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, to kind of give you an overview of the philosophy behind what they're calling not only Race to the Top, but actually philosophically think where they want to move in regard to the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So as we're thinking about this today, I also want you to think about that. I think this is going to have a broader impact upon a lot of federal guidelines and requirements in the future based on some of these slides that you're going to see today, and not only in regard to Race to the Top. President Obama, as you can see, said by 2020, America will once again, his goal is to have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. And what he's looking at is the transition points that are very important for students as they move through the K through actually 16 or 20 years of education. So from birth to five, assuring that all kindergarten students are ready to learn. Then as you go through the elementary to the secondary, that all students enter the middle school with the foundational skills to tackle advanced subjects. And I'll talk a little bit about how Minnesota is really working to do that. Then, as all students move to high school, that they graduate high school on time, prepared for at least 1 year of post-secondary education. And then finally, that all graduates that have gone through a post-secondary experience graduate with opportunities for success in the 21st century. So what are those skills that, that people need to be competitive in this global marketplace? So the key reform aims of, now this is ARRA, the overall stabilization stimulus funds, what we're familiar with, the monies that we've received to stabilize our schools, the Title I monies, the IDA money, the school improvement grant monies, all of those title funds, et cetera, all of that are to do these things, expand and improve early learning, raise standards and assessments. Talking about, we're discussing a group of common core standards for the states to agree upon and raise the assessment opportunities, make them multiple measures. Recruit and retain effective educators, and we're certainly doing a lot of work along that area. Build robust data systems. All states are required to have longitudinal data systems so that we can follow students from pre-kindergarten all the way through their post-secondary opportunity, our work opportunity. Turn around low-performing schools. This is one of the things I think that you're going to see a repeated theme coming out of Secretary Duncan's agency, that he's going to have a strong focus on this. No more excuses. We really have to get the job done. And then expand college access and completion. So moving to better early learning opportunities, we want to improve the quality of programs, expand the access, and increase the coordination between and among early childhood programs. We also want to support the nation's movement toward a coherent system of standards, assessments, curriculum, instruction, and educator development. As we all know, one of the criticisms with No Child Left Behind was that although states were charged to create their own standards around English language arts, math, and science, the standard quality, our expectations were uneven. We in Minnesota nationally are looked to as one of the states with the best standards that have been developed. We are actually working and have been asked to provide feedback on the expectations and quality of the Common Core that is being developed right now, because we have insisted that we will not compromise the work that we have done already. And then also that assessments are vertically aligned, that they're that standards are vertically aligned, internationally benchmarked, and college and career are work ready. We also want to have assessment systems that are fairly and validly measuring progress. So I think you're going to be seeing not only a summative type of assessment that measures our system, but we're also going to be responding to, and I'm sure that Secretary Duncan has heard about the need for more quick feedback for teachers so that they can also inform the instruction during the school year. So I think you'll be seeing a couple of ideas or multiple measures of assessment. And then finally, supporting the development, dissemination, and implementation of curricula that support effective instruction. We can have standards, we can have assessments all day long, but if we don't have our curriculum aligned with those standards and we don't have teachers teaching it, we'll not hit the mark. Then we want to maximize educator talent. We want to dramatically, or the federal government wants to dramatically increase the number of effective educators. We want to decrease the number of ineffective educators. We want to attract and retain a higher percentage of effective educators and eliminate the gap based on income and race and ethnicity. And we want to make teaching and school leadership more attractive as a profession. The data systems are to build transparency, create accountability. It's for performance management, for improving the practice of teaching, and to also encourage innovation. Turning around the lowest performing schools, the federal administration is committed to tackling the dropout crisis, and this means turning around America's 5,000 lowest performing schools. They're looking at requirements that are pretty specific, although this is not new. These are not new requirements. They have been in place with under No Child Left Behind and even under some of our other grant opportunities, that when you get into the status of restructuring, if you have not made AYP for 4 or 5 years, these requirements have been in place for a long time, that the requirement to replace or turn around your schools with new leaders, new staff, look at extended learning time, use data to identify students that are at risk of dropping out, so looking at early warning signs, rewarding effective educators that are willing to turn around schools or work in turnaround schools, and close and closing schools and restarting them as charters. The federal administration is going to work with schools to strengthen state and community colleges. As you know, there is a proposal, and I'm not quite sure where it is in the Senate. I know that it passed the House that was going to infuse community colleges with about $10 billion to provide access, more access to students begin community college. The community college is a very accessible and very strong and quality way of getting students on their way towards a 2 or 4 year degree. And so they are putting a lot of emphasis in the community college system. And frankly, in Minnesota, we are very fortunate to have a very strong community college system. Unlike a lot of states, we really have a very strong and community college system.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Senator Grilla. Yep.
Thank you, Senator Stompton. Commissioner Segrin, you're talking about the community colleges. Is there, and $10 billion, is there anything in place for our technical colleges? And how does that fit into this? It's not on one of the bullets, or maybe you're going to get to it. I'm just curious about the technical colleges.
Good point, Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, to my understanding, I think this is focused on community colleges. Now, I don't know if technical colleges are part of that mix or not, and it actually is legislation that's still moving forward, unless I've missed the announcement that it's been approved by the Senate and is moving to the President's desk for signature. So it is, I think, focused for the most part on community. I can find out and get more details for you on the actual language, but they are. And then they're also talking about, as far as the FAFSA information and all the complicated forms that you have to fill out, they're also trying to streamline that process so that you can actually go online, submit your information, and get feedback right away whether you're eligible or not. So they're trying to do a number of things for every student to make the whole process of going to college a little bit more transparent and easy to do. But I will get you information on that.
Okay.
Senator
Commissioner
Gerlach.
And Senator Gerlach, on the first page on the bottom box on the left-hand side, the one comment that would feed into what your question relates to is the second point, where it talks about support states in moving toward common standards and assessments that are vertically aligned, internationally benchmarked, and college and career readiness, or career ready. So I think when they talk about career ready, you really are kind of talking about more than just what we would say academic college.
Sure. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gerlach.
It struck me as ironic as the basis of this is with this ARRA, which is the federal bailouts that's been going on, which is all supposed to be focused on the economy and putting people to work and jobs, and technical colleges are where the rubber meets the road as far as post-secondary education and directly quick jobs, and yet the focus seems on this seems to be off. It just occurred to me that it wasn't aligned.
Mr. Chair,
aligned.
Remember that, you know, this is just one of lots of billions of dollars that are going to various things. When we get to the race to the top area, that doesn't prohibit us from looking at strategies that where we can incorporate the technical schools into our race to the top strategy and how to get more kids connected with the world of work that our technical schools really do a very, very good job. So this is that when I mentioned the $10 billion initiative that's going through, that's just one piece, but that doesn't exclude that we're not going to do a lot of other things with other kinds of educational programming.
Okay, well, thank you.
Senator Olson probably wants the last word on this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, I think part of the challenge, and I think the system, hasn't acknowledged it yet in the merger of the technical schools is not, we've kind of focused in on the two-year and the four-year degree. Mm-hmm. There are some careers that don't require a full 2 years. And there are, we've had other kinds of programs, but somehow that does not have the respectability or status, or is thrown into the mix and lowers their graduation rate if people don't reach that two-year status. I think somewhere along the way we've got to get some common sense interjected into this system, because it's doing our young people and the programs that can serve them well a disservice.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was holding back on my questions, thinking I would ask at the end, but Senator Gerlach broke the ice, so I'm going to go back a moment. And when you spoke about the emphasis on early childhood, how are those funds being put forward towards early childhood? Because I haven't seen anything specifically towards early childhood.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I think there is an initiative on early childhood. It's another pot of money that is being brought forward that's separate. And I'll get into, and again, that's another proposal that's out on the table. And I don't recall how much money, but it is in the billions that they're looking at for early childhood, too. So it's going to be a separate, I think, competitive grant for, I don't know if it's going to be for states or districts or nonprofits or, you know, consortia. So much of this is dependent on whether it passes. And then after that, it depends on the guidelines and the RFP application, which can be months down the road yet. But there is, I think, some proposals out there for early childhood, too.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, are you planning in your presentation today to let us know how much money has already come to the state through the ERA funds and where that stands in terms of getting out to the districts? Was that in your presentation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, that was not a request for today, but I can certainly give you that information. We can have our financial ARRA staff get you that information. Some of it is, you know, you have to be reimbursed for it, so the districts have to apply for reimbursement. It's on a reimbursement basis, so it's going to be a rolling number over time. I think right, I'm going to say off the top of my head, about maybe 40% has gone out, you know, in various and sundry categories. So it's not all education, but a lot of the money is rolling out. It's just that it has to be requested, you know, based on a budget and reimbursement process.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Commissioner,
Bonner.
I think that the members of the committee would like to, on a regular basis, see some kind of a flow chart of how the money's come in and where it's going. So
are you now, I'm sorry, Senator Bonhoff, are you talking just about education?
Yes.
Now? Okay.
Yes.
We will try to, on a regular basis, get you that information.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Terrazzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is so timely for me, and I wish we've had this hearing a few days ago. I had the opportunity to meet with some members in the White House about 2 days ago, and somehow this came as the number one topic, rise to the top. And unfortunately, I was not prepared to respond to some of the questions they had. This meeting was really to talk about achievement gap and some of the problems some of the states are facing. And the staff that was there really saw this as an opportunity for us to really work on these issues. And as I see your presentation, it occurs to me that one topic that they talk a lot about was the participation from those communities in the process of creating these proposals. And Although our meeting was very brief, I'm thinking now, reflecting during your presentation, Commissioner, that from the staff's comments, I assume that that's going to really be a very important element in the reviews, and that they are going to look at your process very, very carefully. And I hope that you can address this in your presentation, because I think that competing for the funding is going to include that element. That's a question I have. As they were particularly interested in two aspects. One, really the input from communities in a very direct way, and rural participation. They were very emphatic about the process of incorporating rural voices, because usually departments really look at larger cities and complex areas, and they leave out rural communities and small districts. And the second part, if you indulge me, Mr. Chairman, that concerns me is in one of your documents, I get the impression that we're building this proposal based on what we already have, meaning that when we talk about this teacher component, you're already taking QComp as the actual model that we're building on. Am I reading this correctly? So in here, I see that we talk about QComp, principal institute pilot project to comply with these elements of the proposal, and then turning around struggling schools, you're talking about charter schools. Is that the premise of this proposal?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, why don't I go through the rest of the presentation, and I'm sure that I can answer your questions as we get to those things. We also have established a process, and we're going to be spending a lot of time with stakeholders, all stakeholders, as many stakeholders as we possibly can, to get feedback in building our Race to the Top application. The things that you see listed at the end are just examples of things that could fit into a Race to the Top proposal that match some of the requirements. When you see the charter schools, it's only because we were the first in the nation to establish charter schools. It's an obvious thing that we can share with the Department of Education to say, yes, Minnesota has charter school opportunities and options. But we are thinking about lots of different strategies to meet Race to the Top, and these are only just listings of things that fit nicely right now with some of the requirements. But they are not the only things, are the things that we're going to consider, because this is an opportunity for all of us to think about our aspirations for the next 5 years of what the state should look like, and it's our opportunity to really come together and talk about what we would like to do and dream big and to think bold. And they expect us to be very bold in what we're doing. Minnesota has actually been selected as one of the 10 to 15 states in the United States that have one of the best chances of receiving the Race to the Top funds because of some of the very initiatives that are listed, but also because the Gates Foundation and other national experts feel like we have not been reluctant in being bold in what we're doing with our reforms. So we've got a really great opportunity, but it's kind of scary at the same time to think about the expectations for Minnesota and meeting those expectations that some of the national people think that we have an opportunity to meet. So why don't I run through this really quickly, because this is more of an overview of the ARRA stuff, and then we can get into the Race to the Top. This is the major ARRA funding streams. You can see that this is the overview of what the national numbers look like. The state fiscal stabilization fund phase one obligates over $30 billion. That was at the national level. You can see the different requirements we're in the middle of. We just, by October 10th, we have to report our first numbers fiscally of what has been spent in Minnesota. So we're very rapidly trying to put all that information together. Phase two state reporting is going to be set report is against a set of indicators under each assurance. I'm not going to go through all that. You can read it. But we really have a lot of reporting requirements, not only at the local school district level, but at the state level from every kind of department and agency that is affected by ARRA. Our agency itself has actually implemented a new reporting system called SERV. It is taking our old EDRS system and consolidating it or making it complementary to our UFAR system so that in the future we'll have more discrete and more easily reported data. But we've had a lot of training that has happened along that, and But we were going to ramp that up in about 9 months, and we decided we might as well do it now instead of requesting, you know, old processes and then doing it in 9 months. So now the race to the top, there are four policy areas. There's about $4.3 billion that is going as a competitive grant to all states in the nation. The monies are only going to be given out to about 10 to 15 states, so you can see then what the size of that dollar amount could be. We've plugged in just as a figure, but it could get bigger, it could get smaller, of about $250 million. That money can be spent over a four-year time period. It's not going to be like usual federal grants that have to be spent under the Tidings Amendment in 27 months. We have a longer ability, and I appreciate that because sometimes starting new initiatives take more than a couple of years to really see if they're going to work or to give time for them to demonstrate success.
Commissioner, so then just real quickly, where does the 10 to 15 states come from?
From Secretary Duncan's many, many statements.
Okay.
They are not going to, this money is not going to be distributed evenly, equally by formulas or anything to all states. They want this to be a competitive process, race to the top. And so they want to, so that is their position. So the four areas will be looking at human capital, educator effectiveness, data systems, standards and assessments, and school turnaround. As I said, the state competition is about $4 billion, and then they have set aside $350 million to develop assessments around the what they're calling a common core that is being developed by states right now, and we are really in process, or they are in process of developing a common core that states are working on together, and there is a requirement. Well, I'll get to the requirement about that, but the $350 million will be for states to come together as consortia then to develop assessments around eventually whatever is agreed to as this common core of standards. And for both of these pots of money, 50% of it will flow from the states to the LEA. So, for example, if we got $250 million, $125 million of that will go to LEAs. But there is a condition to that. The LEA must sign a memorandum of understanding with the state that they will implement the application requirements. If they don't sign the memorandum of understanding, they will not get their money, and that money will... Well, it's undecided how that money will be distributed. We don't know. We've asked the federal government if that money would then fall back to the state to be redistributed to other LEAs or to other state, you know, initiatives that would be under that application.
Is the requirement that at least 50%, or is it up?
It's 50%.
50%.
Yeah, and up to it. The way we're in the indications that we're getting, Senator Stumpf, is that it would be 50%, but if an LEA did not sign on, then that money probably would fall back to the state, or they may claim claim it back to the federal government. You know, they may give us the money, but that has not been decided. I have asked repeatedly, and they're going, "Huh, we haven't thought about that." So again, this race to the top proposal, the RFP, has not been given out yet. So we're still waiting for it. It was supposed to be out last Friday, and it has been delayed again. So we don't know when it's coming out. But once it does, once the final RFP comes out, we have 60 days in which to apply. So we are in the back of our minds. We've got a December 1st deadline that we're working off of, based on an October 1st RFP. But we're just working aggressively anyway because we would like to get it done and get it solidified before. So the U.S. Department will support states in creating conditions for innovation and reform, both legal and regulatory. They want to enable system-wide approaches to continuous improvement, and they are encouraging state leaders to design a unified state effort around ambitious reforms. They want to support district reform efforts, identify effective practice, replicate and disseminate those practices, and then hold districts accountable for outcomes. And they are looking at repurposing and aligning the ARRA and other funds to have the most dramatic impact. So what that means is your IDEA, your Title I, your school improvement grant monies, your innovative grant money that's going to be coming out for districts in a very short period of time. Any of the grants, our R2T2 funds that are technology, everything that we are going to be receiving over the next year or two, they want to see it all integrated and complementary to one another so that, you know, let's take our technology monies. If we are going to have an application process for that, and that technology monies could enhance something that is going on in Race to the Top or school improvement grants or whatever, it all is supposed to be one unified type of thinking and system so that we're not just having fractured things going on, but it's all supposed to support the total kind of aspirational goals that are in Race to the Top. Here is the preliminary deadline for Race to the Top. October was supposed to be the notice inviting applications. Then an application deadline for phase one would be a 2 months or 60-day application process. Winners would be announced in March of 2010. Then for phase two, there would be an application process in June with a September announcement of winners. If you don't receive the money in the first phase, if you apply in the first phase, you can reapply in the second phase. If you're a winner in the first phase, you can't apply for the second phase. So that is kind of what we're working off of. This is about the innovation funds, the $650 million that's going for a competitive process for school districts. And information is just starting to trickle out about the innovation funds. So we are going to try to make sure that our school districts get as much information as quickly as possible. It'll be a separate but must align with the Race to the Top and State Fiscal Stabilization Fund priorities. LEAs and nonprofits in partnership with LEAs would be eligible to receive these funds. The competitive grant program for the Race to the Top is to encourage states to create conditions for education innovation and reform, achieve significant improvements in educational outcomes, make substantial gains in student achievement, close the achievement gap, improve high school grad rates, ensure student preparation for success in college and career, and implement ambitious plans in four core education areas. And again, we've kind of gone over these several times, but standards and assessment, effective teachers and principals, data systems, and turning around our schools. The standards and assessments must show that it is developing and adopting common state standards. So this is one of the conditions of the Race to the Top grant. There are 49 states that are participating in this common core development right now. And as I said, Minnesota has been one of three states that have been consistently cited as reviewers and people that they are looking at for their quality of standards. Massachusetts and Florida and California in some instances have been the states consistently that they keep going back to for review and comment. And then we are to also develop and implement, have the commitment that we're developing and implementing common high-quality assessments. So those are sort of non-negotiables that at least for the time being, for all that we know right now with the application, that these are still going to be requirements to receive Race to the Top funds. That may change, but right now that's what we're working off of. The state must show a plan to support statewide transition to these enhanced standards. They must align high school exit criteria and college entrance requirements with the new assessments, develop disseminating and implementing curricular frameworks and materials, develop and deliver formative and interim assessments. We talked a little bit about that. And develop and deliver professional development materials. So, Senator Torres-Ray, when you were talking about some of the things at the end of this presentation that would possibly fit into this, for example, we have created math and science academies for our teachers. So when you look at developing and delivering professional development for our teachers, this is one thing that we could certainly consider to ramp up to really do a very robust training and development. I would love to also create an academy for reading, for English language arts, for professional development along the Common Core, too. So it's an example of something that we already have started to work on that we could really ramp up, and it's already being done regionally, and we could really make that a bigger, bolder initiative. So that's an example of something that we could do because we've already got it established. For the data system, states must show that they are fully implementing a statewide longitudinal data system that includes all of the elements of the America Competes Act. We have, there are 10 elements. We have 8 of them completed, and there are 2 left to do. One is to track students' course-taking patterns, so we have to create a common course catalog so that we can then attach that student's record to the courses they're taking, and then also link the teacher to those courses and to the students. So then we can also see who's taught that class and what kids have participated in that teacher's classroom. Those are the 2 elements that are left to do. And then we must show a plan for increasing the system-wide use of data. So it's not just about creating and reporting this, but it's how are we going to use that data for research purposes, for improvement of instruction. For me, it's crazy to just collect reams of data and never use it productively and effectively to improve our instruction. So they do definitely want that. And they want to incentivize the use of data, as I said, to improve the structure of your educational system, both K-12 and higher ed. The state must show a reform plan that ensures that the data from the state's LDS are accessible to and used by appropriate stakeholders for data-driven decision-making and continuous improvement, to increase the use of instructional improvement systems where teachers and school leaders use reliable data to inform instruction, and make the LDS available to researchers to evaluate the effectiveness of instructional materials, etc. Now, great leaders and teachers, states must show how they are providing alternative pathways for aspiring teachers and principals, and show a plan for differentiating teacher and principal effectiveness based on performance. And then ensuring equitable distribution of effective teachers and principals, report the effectiveness of teacher and principal preparation programs, and provide effective support to teachers and principals. A couple of things we already have in place in Minnesota, again getting to Senator Torres-Ray's comment, we have established a principal institute for the training of existing or already licensed principals. We would love to look at the preparation of principals to align with that principal institute comprehensive program. And there is a lot of discussion at the national level about evaluation systems for both principals and teachers. How would that look if you wanted to establish an evaluation system for both? So those are discussions we will have to have with stakeholders. Those are some of the requirements that the U.S. Department of Education is going to be looking for. Most states don't have evaluation systems that are a statewide type of framework. They might have an individual evaluation system done at the local education level, but not at a state level. So we're going to have to explore that with our stakeholders and see what we can suggest doing. We have a good framework based on QCOMP. That's why QCOMP is mentioned, because there is evaluation required. Can we use that as sort of a framework, whether you're in QCOMP or not in QCOMP? Would that be something that we could do? Now, getting to turning around struggling schools, states must show how they are intervening in the persistently lowest performing schools and increasing the supply of high-quality charter schools. We don't have any issue with charter schools as far as the supply. We are focused, however, and I'm glad to see that we have a lot of charter folks here, of trying to make sure, and especially with the work that we've done this last legislative session, making sure that we ensure high-quality charter schools and making sure that The philosophy behind charter schools was if they are not effective, close them down. And if we have really good charter schools, what are the strategies that we can create to replicate good charter schools? And if there are national models, how can we bring those in to the state? But I think, again, that's an area where we're working at it. We don't have nearly the issues that other states would have. So I think we'll meet that pretty easily. And then the state plan to turn around struggling schools with a transformation model that would include new leadership and charter status. That's controversial. You know, we have done, and certainly in a couple of our school districts, they have done fresh starts, turned around, closed down charter school or closed down schools. We haven't necessarily converted anybody to charters, but we have the ability to do that if you want. So nobody has been prohibited from doing that. Then there is a competitive emphasis on STEM. And I've kind of said, we got that one nailed in Minnesota as far as all of the work that we have been doing around the STEM area, that I think we can very easily assure that this is an area that we're very competitive and that we can be very strong in that area. Requiring a rigorous course of study in math, science, technology, and engineering. As you know, our science standards have an engineering strand, K through 12 now. Cooperate with STEM-capable community partners. We have some very robust partners with a lot of our high-tech association members, our business partnerships, so we've got really some very good, strong things going on. And preparing more students for advanced study. We've had very aggressive policies around advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools, dual credit, early college. There's just a list of things that are going on in Minnesota that are very successful, and we can demonstrate that we're doing. Then there are some invitational priorities. There is no bonus points for this. Unlike the STEM one, there is additional points for that, but these are priorities that you can consider. P20 coordination and vertical alignment. Certainly, we have a very robust and active P20 partnership that we could probably, you know, demonstrate would be a nice invitational demonstration. And then school-level conditions for reform and innovation, which they're requesting to show how we would select staff, implement new structures and formats for a school day, placing budgets under school control, performance-based credit, comprehensive services for high-need students. So we could think about areas there that we might want to pursue as a state. There might be some nice things that could fit under there. You all passed this last year the Innovative School Council. Thank you. And they are busy meeting and working, and this might be a nice initiative to highlight as another invitational priority of a way that Minnesota is creating new opportunities for innovation. States must demonstrate that during this 4 years, we're going to make significant progress in closing the achievement gap. And as I said, also have the coordination of all the other ARA and federal state money. They'll be favorable towards reform in terms of their policies and laws. So we need to make sure that we don't have any laws that are prohibiting or that we have policies and laws in place that are encouraging. And we have a lot of laws and policies in place, I think, that are very positive. So I think we're in good shape there. That we have to increase student achievement and decrease the achievement gap as report on NAEP. Our NAEP scores are going to come out pretty soon here in a week or so. We also have the wonderful TIMSS information that has shown some very significant progress. If you look at the NAEP scores from 1992 on, we have made significant progress, but our achievement gap is still abysmal. So we're going to be a little shaky here, but we're going to try to demonstrate some of the good, strong progress that we have made with our growth model. We may be able to also demonstrate that even though our students aren't right at proficiency, that we are showing some very strong growth. So we'll probably be looking at some information like that. We want to make sure that education funding is a priority and demonstrate that. and that it is supported. And this is to Senator Torres Rey's comment or question about supported by a wide array of stakeholders. And let me tell you a little bit about our timeline. Because we received funding from the Gates Foundation, we were able to hire a consultant that is helping us implement a lot of and help us write the Race to the Top and help us do a lot of the things that we need to do. On October 1st, we had our first kind of high-level stakeholders meeting with institutional heads, with state chairs, with people that are kind of the first touch in talking about what Race to the Top should look like. We're going to have another repeat meeting. We haven't covered all of the four areas, principles that we have to meet. We're having another meeting on the 13th of October, and then we'll probably have another third meeting in November. However, that's not the sum total. And also, in addition to that, Senator Torres Rey, all of the minority councils have been invited and attended except for one. And we are going to, when anyone did not show up, we are going to have a very aggressive one-on-one meetings with them and make sure that we have multiple opportunities for feedback. Then we're also going to have regional meetings all the week of the last week of October. We're going out regionally, and we're going to be inviting the teachers, the school board members, the management, and parents and community members and business to come to a regional meeting that we'll be holding all across the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, we will then be coming around and working individually with organizations, educational organizations, such as the teachers, such as the school boards, such as the superintendents, such as the principals, to get even more in-depth feedback from their membership so that we make sure that we have that. We will be coming around again with the higher education institutions and their institutional heads to, again, make sure that we have a lot of feedback. So we are trying to do as much as we possibly can in this very short period of time to get the information that we need to build a good Race to the Top application. On first blush, our first meeting showed great consistency of support and alignment with the guidance principles. So just in first blush, things are looking really good. We're hoping also with the legislative committees that we will have an opportunity to meet with the legislative committees so that we have a time again to go through that same process that we went through with this stakeholders group, talking about your aspirations, talking about the really hard things about what should be our solutions. A lot of people say, yeah, we should do this, but when it comes down to the real hard, big, bold reform ideas, it's hard for them to put their minds around it, except for sometimes we should do this little program. But this is about big, bold, fundamental, foundational change. And so it's good work, and it's actually exciting work. I enjoyed the very first meeting. I just sat in the back of the room. But I can tell you, people were working hard, and they were exhausted by the end of the day. So I expect that you all will be, too. But it'll be really good, wonderful work when it's all said and done. Again, we also must demonstrate that we've raised the overall achievement gap as measured by NAEP, and that we must raise graduation rates, and we must build strong statewide capacity. So at the end of the 4 years, we also need to demonstrate that this is not going to go away, that we are so committed to what we're doing that regardless of whether I'm here, or Senator Bonhoeff is here, or the chair is here, or whoever the governor is, that we're still committed to this and the sustainability of it. And that's probably the hardest thing for any state and any legislature and any governor to do in this country is creating that sustainability. But it really is an exciting opportunity for us to make that commitment. So for whoever is here, to carry on that really strong commitment and message that we have potentially created here for Race to the Top. And I want to tell you, too, at the end of the day, when this is all said and done, even if we don't get the Race to the Top, I hope that this will be not only an exercise, but it will be something that we all can come around together and provide the support that our districts need in the future. It's a great, really wonderful opportunity, and I'm excited about it. Now, I want to just go over some of the reasons why lots of people at the national level are thinking that Minnesota is a good chance. Our standards are being viewed as a national model. Our assessments are aligned to the standards and being revised to match our college-ready entrance requirements. And I want to say our science test is the first of its kind in the nation that was a computerized, state-of-the-art video and audio streaming type of test that actually allows for the analysis of a constructed response type of response without it being something that has to be scored separately. And many, many states are interested in replicating our model because we've created it. And the federal government is very interested in it. So, again, it's something that we've quietly done. We don't get a lot of, you know, we don't brag about it or anything as a legislator or, you know, a legislature or as a agency, but it's work that's been done. Teachers have been reform-minded and participating in QComp and other performance reforms. Not only is our state, but we've got a lot of school districts that have done some good work in this area. We've got one of the boldest reform initiatives in the country right now. No other state has 44 school districts and 20 or so charter schools that are participating in a comprehensive framework for school, for teachers, that's professional development, etc. Our school leaders, we've got our program for principals that has been in place, and we also have laws and policies that for decades have been showing the reform commitment that we have in the state of Minnesota. So this came long before me as far as a lot of the reform initiatives, and it's been really fun to be part of seeing this grow as we go forward. We have an LDS system that is legally in place. Our STEM initiatives are seen as nation-leading. Our college and career readiness infrastructure is well underway with dual credit and early indicator work. And our participation as a state in TIMSS has showed strong trends in our students becoming very competitive. And there's a lot more stuff that we could list, but just to kind of give you the highlights of how we might be able to meet some of those guidance principles is really exciting. So,
great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, for all the information and giving us insight into this. We have a number of questions, and we'll start out with Senator Bonhoeff, and then Senator Olson, and Senator Tresri, and then myself. Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, before I go into my questions, just a comment. I appreciate your enthusiasm, Commissioner, and how you're attacking this with such strength and leadership, because I share your belief that this really does have the capacity to bring us together all over the state of Minnesota so that we can rally around how important it is to transform education in Minnesota for our children, to transform the quality of public education so every child in this state has the same kind of opportunities. And it is very inspiring and very exciting to be able to be a part of putting this together. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And also, I just, you know, an add-on comment to that is I recognize that the work we're doing here this year and last year and next year stands on the shoulders of the legislators and the chairs and the stakeholders that have been doing this for 10 years. And so that we have this opportunity is a testament to all the people in this room and all the people who have come before us. So I really appreciate that as well. The one question I had is going back to the criteria that we're being judged on in terms of putting forward our application. I noticed and have been seeing the criteria with regard to teacher quality, improving teacher quality, and specifically the criteria around the alternative pathways. And so I had gotten from the staff a document from the Federal Register, which is a document that lists the rules of implementation for a bill. So I wanted to just briefly read what it says and then ask for you to comment in more depth on that. So this is around great teachers and leaders. It says that we must provide alternative pathways for aspiring teachers and principals. The extent to which the state has in place legal, statutory, or regulatory provisions that allow alternative routes to certification, as defined in this notice, for teachers and principals, particularly routes that allow for providers in addition to institutions of higher education, and the extent to which these routes are in use. So can you just talk about what, in fact, we would have to put in place from a statutory perspective, and given that we don't yet have that, how we can address that, and what's the timing, you know, if we express a commitment to do that in the future, does that make a difference?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, these are the rules that are the proposed requirements. We don't have it finalized yet, so I want to make sure that we all understand that this may change. But we do have, the Board of Teaching does have language where they are allowed to approve alternative routes to teaching. So we do have rule that does allow that. I know that there was an attempt last session to also provide a real clear direction about alternative pathways for teachers. We also have the Q program. I don't know that it would be called an alternative, but it is a program that is for recruiting minority members into the profession. But I think it's more of a traditional path through a traditional system, and I don't know to the extent that it's a more ramped up or aggressive process. So I think they're looking at processes for mid-career changers. They're probably looking at, frankly, something like a Teach for America model, new teachers for new schools. Those are all things that Secretary Duncan has used in Chicago, and I've kind of laughed about, when President Bush became president. Since he was from Texas, everything we did for education was from Texas and their model. And now, of course, Secretary Duncan and President Obama coming from Chicago and seeing what they did in Chicago, now everything's kind of a Chicago model and what they did and based on, alternative pathways and some of the other things. So we kind of chuckle about that it seems like whoever, comes to the forefront brings their biases or their experiences with them.
Can you give us a Chicago accent?
I can't do it in Chicago. Probably my Missouri accent is probably as close to Chicago as you want to get. So, and there are a few things that I try to be very careful how I pronounce, even with my Missouri accent. I sometimes flub up, though. So I think that we will have to explore that. I think we just have to wait for the guidelines. We also had proposed last year, from the administration's perspective, a U-Teach type of framework. That is an alternative model that recruits science and math majors that are in school now to become teachers. Again, it's probably not. I don't know if that would be called an alternative pathway or not. But those are some things that we also can explore, too. So I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens with the guidelines to see about it. But, yeah, I think we're going to have to demonstrate some commitment to alternative pathways.
Thanks. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. A lot of hard work that's already done here. I would just encourage you, in light of the fact that our NAEP scores in the area of reading have been rather stagnant, that you not overlook what we've been able to achieve in terms of strengthening the preparation of teachers for in all of the tools that they need to help struggling readers. And I think, and also I think hopefully we'll be able to encourage, it would strengthen our proposal too, if we can encourage the schools to use some of their staff development monies and other things to try to get, gear up for helping existing teachers have the tools to do it too, because that's as foundational as it comes. If you can't read, you're not going to get very far in much of the other areas. So I hope you will acknowledge in your application what we have done and that we can commit to carrying that on.
Mr. Chair and
I think I'm speaking for Senator Saltzman and maybe
Senator
Olson
and Senator Salzman. Yes, we certainly are going to be looking at the work of the legislature and especially in the work that you've done in the reading area. As I mentioned, it would be wonderful to create reading or English language arts academies, just like we're doing with math and science, because, again, it's one of the common core that it would just be wonderful to have very consistent statewide training in all three of these areas on a consistent basis, where teachers are always continually honing their skill, doing the kinds of things that will help them, and all teachers, not just elementary, but all teachers having an experience.
Senator Terizzeri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I really believe that we have an amazing opportunity, and I believe that our state is ready to seize that opportunity. As I meet with teachers and principals and parents, I believe that this is a tremendous opportunity for us. But as a person of color who actually run for office because of this issue and because of disparities, that was the reason I run. I didn't want to be in this office because it's so glamorous. I really wanted to, or because we have a good salary. I just really wanted to do this. I wanna publicly say that it is not enough that you invite the councils of color to provide input. You need to invite people who actually know pedagogy and actually understand disparities. And I am not going to accept input from people of color who only have dark skin. I want people who actually know what it means to close achievement gap. I will be happy to give you a list of experts, local and national, who can actually give you specific language that you can incorporate into this proposal. And I feel very strongly, just because I came back from Washington, this is timely for me and very emotional. Minnesota is viewed as one amazing state in terms of indicators. But disparities is an issue that puts us behind in every area, and I had it enough. I do believe that we have talent and resources to address that, but it will not be by asking people of color that do not know these issues. It will be by asking people who actually understand and care very deeply about this. You have the obligation to do so. There are people in your staff who were actually hired to do so, and so reviewing Dr. Ferguson's material, Dr. Noguera's material, is what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And I would really like to see that in this proposal. And I am going to go as far as saying that if I don't see this in this proposal, I will not be supporting it. And you will know locally and you will know nationally that I will not support Minnesota's proposal if it is not a serious proposal. And it does not have serious steps to really address these key elements, which are closing achievement gap, raising graduation standards. This is very clear. The feds are very clear on that. And I know that Minnesota can do it. So I just want you to know that I feel very strongly that I know Minnesota can do it, but we have to work on it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, you have my commitment certainly too. We are trying to reach out to as many groups of people as possible, and I would love to have a list of resources from you that we can have another individual meeting with and bring those people together. We started just with kind of the, you know, obvious groups of folks, but we are certainly reaching out and trying to reach out to many, many people. And so to the extent any of you have groups of folks that we've missed on, please don't hesitate to suggest meetings with them, because we want to be as inclusive and to get the right people at the table. I agree with you, because sometimes when you invite somebody, it's like, well, okay, and they give you some comments, but they're not as engaged. So please, we would encourage that. So any groups that you have. Your comment, too, about rural Minnesota is very important to me, too. We are going to make very, very strong attempts at reflecting the rural needs also. We've had a lot of discussion at the chief state school officer level about, you know, because you've got Montana's, you've got Iowa's, you've got Nebraska, you've got Kansas. You have many states that are just comprised of very small school districts. And some of the things that are suggested here in the race to the top just don't fit little, small, tiny rural school districts. And we really have to think strategically about the needs of children in rural schools, too. So we are trying to be very comprehensive and think about a comprehensive structure. And believe me, Senator Torres-Rae, if I have to sit in front of a microphone at NPR one more time and say, well, has the achievement gap closed any further, Commissioner? And I say, well, it closed a little bit. We've got maybe a few subgroups that moved up about 5 percentage points, but the gap is still big. I'm just going to tear my hair out. We've got to do a better job. I was recently meeting with the ACT folks. As you know, we're number one again in the nation as far as our ACT scores. And we compete back and forth with Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And we are getting more of our students of color participating in the ACT, which is good. So we're starting to see movement, and their scores are, and even our minority students, our scores, their scores are higher than at the national level. So they're doing better, but it's still this huge achievement gap. What they said was that Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin are at a tipping point. Our states are now becoming much more strongly minority, and if we don't take this opportunity right now to do something very aggressive about helping these students, and it's a very complex issue, we will be swamped and overwhelmed by a generation of children that will be underprepared and not be able to support themselves. And this will get to be a larger and larger problem. We have got a really strong educational system in Minnesota. There's no excuse. There's no excuse for any of us to not make a difference in the lives of these children. So we're committed to doing that. And Senator Torres-Rae, we'll get people contacting you today.
Commissioner, just to kind of piggyback on what Senator Torres-Rae mentioned, last session we had a number of discussions about the Q-Comp and the ability for small schools to participate. And I think there's some similarities here, and it would be a real opportunity for us to figure out how we can overcome those difficulties. And I think we identified a few areas. One is that small schools don't have the resources, the grant writers, the they can't afford the sub-teachers. There's just a host of little things that prevent them from participating at the same level as other districts. So I think this maybe gives us an opportunity to take care of two problems at once. And it would be great because I think rural communities, rural schools contribute a lot to the whole state. I know all of our children are down here or in one metropolitan area or another. And I think that's true from a lot of different rural communities is that the children have become very productive citizens in metropolitan areas. So I'm looking forward to working with you. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question, Commissioner Seguin, is who decides on to pursue this application process? Is that a decision that's just made in the department when the notice came out from the federal government, or was it decided at the governor's office? I mean, there was no legislative vote, but who decides to pursue this program or not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, the application and the authority to apply for the application resides in the governor's office. So the governor makes the decision to apply, and the application actually has to be submitted and signed by the governor and the commissioner. Otherwise, you can't do it.
Okay, I was just curious about that. And if I could, just for a moment, to permit me to be skeptical about the federal government. That's my nature. That's what I do. So the federal government, we've been down this road many times of what we are hopeful of, some great education initiatives, some new reforms, going back as far as just what I can remember. I mean, in the early 90s, I mean, we had the OBE, or outcome-based education, which caused all sorts of anguishes. You probably were on the school board maybe around that time, right? And then we went into the Goals 2000, which was the federal initiatives under the Clinton administration. And back in Minnesota, we went down this path of the profile of learning. And we did, and then we have a new administration in Washington, and then we get the No Child Left Behind, and now we have what appears to be at least the foundation of a new administration, now a new program here. And these always come with money and lots of strings attached. And we always go down the struggle of local control versus federal or state control. And it just... It makes me nervous. I would ask the rhetorical question, but for the money, would we be even having a slideshow? Or would we just continue to do the things in Minnesota that we do better and are leading the nation in and continue to do that? I just think, but for the money, would we even be talking about this? And the lead-in on the handout, the very top lead-in at the top page says, Race to the Top has the promise of significant funding to states and LEAs that meet the challenge. So it seems like that's the premise that's driving it, is the desire, the hunger, the need for money, and that we almost seem to be willing to do anything and jump through any hoops for this money, and we always pursue that. So that makes me nervous, and just something that we should think carefully about. A serious question I have is about the curriculum. There's one of the slides we had, it says standards and assessment, says support the nation's movement toward a coherent system of standards, assessments, and curriculum instruction. The nation's movement towards a national, essentially, curriculum. That to me raises all sorts of red flags. And the issue is, who decides a national curriculum? That frightens me to death. We have enough struggles with the state versus the school districts on what the curriculum should be. Now, in the pursuit of money, are we giving up a lot in return of that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, under the application to date, there is no requirement that we're going to be establishing a national curriculum. Are any consortium of people coming together with curriculum. The way we would treat that in Minnesota, because we don't have statewide curriculum, that's been a very strong principle that we've held for years and years and years. I don't think that we've ever gone back on that, ever, even a discussion about it. What we would do, and what was really successful when we changed from the profile to our first MCA 1, you know, in math and reading, et cetera, we created what they call curriculum frameworks, and all it was is just a framework for teachers to look at their curriculum and say, does your curriculum have these benchmarks in it? You know, make sure to align your curriculum, whatever it is. So whether it's Scott Forsman or, you know, whatever the textbook you're using, just make sure that these things are in your textbooks that you're using. And if not, then get some supplemental materials. That's the way we would look at it. And there is no requirement for national curriculum that we have ever heard discussed. And we've been very clear at meetings that we will not go there as a state. And we've also been very clear, frankly, that if the common standards that are developed at the end of the day, if we don't feel that they meet our standards that we've developed, that we will not go there. And if that's decided, the discussion will be ended. We will not go for Race to the Top.
Okay, well, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, I hope that's the case, because we tend to get into things easier than we can get out of them sometimes, and we get wrapped around all sorts of problems when we start getting into the curriculum, and that's...
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, whether you are a Republican, whether you're a Democrat, whether you are on the liberal-leaning side, whether you're on the conservative-leaning side, These are all very, very good things that we should be discussing as states. How much do we want, you know, some outside entity to control our destiny? And we've had, as you said, this discussion for many, many years, the federal and the state relationship in regard to education. Lots, billions of dollars have been poured into education by the federal government, and billions of dollars have been poured into education through our state coffers, too. And I think wherever the money is coming from, we just have to get down to the really serious discussion about where is the beef? Where is the accountability? Where are the results for all of this money? I think that's why, you know, we got No Child Left Behind, because the federal government was finally tired of pouring billions of dollars into Title I and not getting any results. So you then had this NCLB framework, good or bad, et cetera. And now we've got this evolving again. It's kind of the nature of the governmental beast to be continuing to grapple with these decisions. They're very important decisions. And we should continue to be asking ourselves those very questions that you're asking as we go forward.
We're going to take another question, and then I believe there's some people who would like to testify. So I'm hoping that we can wrap this up fairly quickly. So, Senator Saltzman?
There's just a very quick question, if I may, Mr. Chair, and that is on will somehow we be able to address our site-governed school legislation in here? Because I know when you mentioned about turning around struggling schools that, you know, chartering is an option, and I think that chartering is a way to develop a school, but it's not any different than perhaps another school. So will we be able to I do know that some of the folks at Education Evolving are talking to some of the people on the federal level to look at what we've done here in Minnesota, that this is another option, there isn't a monopoly, that there's only one way to turn around struggling schools. So is that something that we might be able to include, as well as maybe to just mention very briefly with early intervention and RTI models that have been so successful in Minnesota, and that kind of goes with the Reading Corps. Can we build those things in? Because those are also great things that we've tried to support here in the Senate.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, yes, all of those things are on the table as far as the things that we've got going on right now in Minnesota. That's what they want to see. They want to see states that have really done innovative things, that want to ramp them up, that, you know, haven't had the ability to do it. They want us to be a laboratory, but they want it to be based on really good practice and research. So we've got to demonstrate that as we're doing it. So I think all of the things that you mentioned are opportunities that we can discuss and see how they fit into a Race to the Top application.
Hey, I'm going to call, I believe, is Grace, Grace Keller from MSBA. And then I'd like to also invite the MREA to maybe just comment, too. And anyone else, hopefully relatively short.
Thank you, Mr. Ms. Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have been working very closely with our national organization, looking at the regulation side of the docket, as the commissioner alluded to. So it is a publication requirement by the federal government that we're allowed to make comments on, and MSBA participated in that process. And then the department will decide what are the guidelines for Race to the Top. I did give you a document that has all our concerns in it. It's 10 pages, and I won't drone through it again for you this afternoon, but I want to talk about the turnaround models. These regulations get very clear in what they're looking at in a turnaround school model. And there's four approaches, and the first one is a change of 50% of your staff, changing your school governance, which in Minnesota would be our school boards, and a change in principal leadership at the school level, and an addition of other programs, whether it be add-on after-school programs for children. So that's the first one we can do. The second one we're allowed to look at is bringing in a charter school or a management school for that firm. Also a governance change in that piece. The third one is closing the school that has the problem. And the fourth is sort of an option. If none of those first three can be doable in your school district, you can use a combination of these pieces. And as we look at it as a state association, we see real conflicts with the present state law and continuing contract rights, how these would be achieved. And there's no recognition in these federal regulations, which, other than to comment on the federal regs, sort of like our rules, we don't can't get a voice in, is that there's no local innovation. A lot of what we've done in Minnesota really does tone to local innovation by school districts confronting what they see as their student challenges. This plan and these regulations for the Race to the Top funds don't give us that kind of flexibility. I also want to bring forward that we've talked about rural schools today, and I appreciate that, but the rural schools, you closed your AYP school, where do those kids go? I mean, it just doesn't even think outside the box of what local school districts have to face. And as these, this is, as I said, the comment period has done, we participated in that process, and you have the letter that we went with NSBA with, but these will then be published and go into effect. So I just want to make sure that your eye is on multiple balls. We're really comfortable in participating with the department on our state plan, but these would go into how this program really rolls out, and there's not a lot that the state can do about it. But to us, it has severe consequences if these schools don't achieve. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, Mr. Chairman, and answer any questions.
Ms. Keller, these rules are already through a process, so we can't impact the rules, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. They're very similar. They're regulations. So the notice, when the commissioner talked about the notice, is what was published, and they basically allow comment like we do to Minnesota rules. We have a comment period we can do. That period is over. So now the department is deciding what will be in and out, which is a national Department of Education decision. And the four turnaround models recommended in the original proposal bring great concern to us, and it's a piece that you would have to accept if you accepted Race to the Top fund.
Commissioner, is there opportunity for us in our application to accommodate some of the concerns?
Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to comment on Ms. Kelleher's comments. I think there's a couple of things going on. I think she's – are you talking about the school improvement grant and how that interacts with Race to the Top?
Mr. Chairman, Kelleher? Commissioner, the Race to the Top grant – and the school innovation funds. Innovation has a little bit more flexible turnaround model in it than these Race to the Top funds do. And so, but it's along a similar path.
Yeah.
So it seems to be a model the federal government, as Commissioner stated, is really trying to put into every piece of the pie at the federal level.
Mr. Chair, the application process, as Ms. Kelleher has said, there was an open comment period where you could comment on the proposed application requirements, and that now has closed, and they have been spending many days and weeks, apparently, looking at all the comments as they make the final decision as to what the actual RFP will finally look like. So we don't know if some of this is going to stay or whether it's going to be softened, modified somewhat to give some flexibility to states. I think that under the school improvement grants, that those requirements for turnaround have been in place for a long time. They just never were actually enforced. And so I think they're now saying, well, this is your choice, that you've got to do this. And so the school improvement grants actually have been finalized. So there'll be a competitive process for districts to apply. But there are levels of turnaround strategies, and so we will see how we're going to be able to implement that. As far as Race to the Top, again, we're waiting to see what the opportunity is. As Ms. Kelleher said, for rural school districts, some of this is not workable. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see a little bit of reality about how to deal with some of these circumstances, because it just doesn't work in all cases. And again, you know, as Senator Gerlach mentioned, sometimes when the federal government tries to do a concept, they start to get kind of too one-size-fits-all, and it doesn't work. And so you really do have to try to adjust. So we're just waiting to see how we're going to handle this.
Ms. Kelleher, has MSBA forwarded this information? I see it. The letter is directed to Secretary Duncan, but to our congressional and U.S. Senate members?
Mr. Chairman, we've forwarded it on to them. And we'll be working with them. We're going to be going out in February and talking again and meeting with them, encouraging them to help us do that. But when it comes right down to it, we have so many fewer representatives than other states that it makes it difficult. Some states are going to like this better than others. We will share it with them, Mr. Chairman, and we'll continue to follow up on it because we have massive concerns about this issue.
Mr. Chair, also, just to give you a little lay of the land, I think right now the number of schools in Minnesota that are, you know, probably in the turnaround category, I think, are in the 30s. And many of those reside in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And those school districts actually have done some of those turnaround strategies where they've fresh started them, where they've put in a new principal or reconstructed the staff. Some of them have closed buildings and things, too. I think we have two rural areas that also are in turnaround. And I don't know if they are schools or if they are districts. So just to kind of give you an impact about this, it may not be as big of an issue as it would be maybe for some other states that have a large, you know, maybe larger populations of schools, because we do know that Minneapolis and St. Paul have already followed some of these strategies. So,
all right, we'll keep in touch and also maybe follow up on that. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? All right. Any other questions? I know Senator Bonhoff and Senator Therese Ray have the integration subcommittee meeting, and I would suggest maybe instead of a half-hour break, maybe 5 minutes.
That's
so
fine.
I want to thank you, Commissioner, and others who have testified and given us this information. There's a lot to digest here, and it looks like a lot to start working on for the next session. So thank you, members, and we'll just stay in the room. Okay, and the committee will be adjourned.
Yeah, you can adjourn because she's going to okay. The subcommittee.
Exactly.
I did the rest.
Told me some of the reading stuff that I sent over to you. You haven't seen yet, but it's on your desk.
It's on my desk.